Case of the day, Sharon Bogan versus the City of Chicago, number 10-2170. Mr. Flaxman.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. In a criminal case, when police officers enter and search a home without a warrant and rely on hot pursuit, the officers must be able to justify or to articulate to a court that they objectively, reasonably believe that a crime suspect was inside. This is a civil case. One question in this case is whether the officers have that same burden to show that they objectively, reasonably believe that a crime suspect was inside the house. In a case that involved consent to enter a home, the Valens case, this court said that burden doesn't rest with the officers, it rests with the civil rights plaintiff. Four other circuits have considered the burden question with respect to a home entry in hot pursuit and have held that the burden rests with the officers, just like in a criminal case. I think there are two circuits that haven't reached that or that have I think the Second Circuit has acknowledged that it hasn't decided that point. The district judge in this case felt compelled to follow the Valens case and instructed the jury that the burden is with the plaintiff to prove that the officers that officers could not have reasonably believed that there was a suspect inside her home.
So on this issue, your main problem is you've got to show us why Valens shouldn't control.
And I think we've set that out in the written submissions, and I definitely I could say that. Is better than what I wrote. If the court has questions on that, I'd be glad to entertain them.
Well, why is it different in this situation? I think we had hot pursuit here. Why would that be different from what we have in Valens, which was a consent case?
The consent case, the person who's consenting knows whether their will was overborne or whether they consented because of the officer said they had a warrant. All of the facts about consent are within the knowledge of the civil rights plaintiff. For exigent circumstances, it's the officers who know why it is that they believe that there's a crime suspect inside the house, that they heard somebody in there, that they smelled somebody in there. It's what the officers knew before they entered that creates that proves the exigency.
So it's the difference of who has the knowledge.
That's correct. The Valens case is also a search, and the court relied in part upon the fact that there was a car search and that there's special rules, as we all know, for car searches. This is a home. This instruction that plaintiff proposed, which was rejected by the judge, didn't talk about burden of proof. I think burden of proof is a very helpful concept for lawyers. It's helpful in summary judgment. There's research that indicates juries don't understand what burden of proof means, that it's confusing and it's a meaningless phrase. And the plaintiff presented an instruction that...
What research indicates that? It's certainly not consistent with my experience.
I know. Everybody's anecdotal experience is that juries like it. That's what the district judge said, that it's his experience that juries really need to know that. But I think there's been social science research which says it's a confusing phrase and... It's not cited in the brief. It's not. I'm not urging. We're not disputing that the district judge has the discretion to instruct on burdens of proof. If I was at
the if the judge wouldn't and it was requested to, you've got to tell the jury that the standard here. This is a civil case. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt.
That's the standard of proof he instructed on. It's a preponderance, more likely than not. But the question of whose burden it is to prove things, is plaintiff has to prove that, but to instruct the jury that, plaintiff has to prove her case by a preponderance of the evidence, but here the officers were relying on exigent circumstances and who has to prove that there were exigent circumstances, is confusing to a jury.
Do you think it would be less confusing to the jury if the district judge followed... If we were to adopt your position and tell the district judge that the plaintiff bears the burden of proving many elements of her claim, but the defense then has the burden of proving the absence of other elements of the claim, and we'd have a pretty complex body burden shifting here under Fourth Amendment doctrine, it seems to be, under that approach.
Well, I think Your Honor is making the case, is explaining why we're not arguing that it's error to instruct about burdens of proof. I think it's within the district court's discretion. It's clear that
where's the error here? What did the trial judge do wrong?
The error is that the district judge instructed the jury that it's plaintiff's burden to prove that officers would not have reasonably believed that they were in hot pursuit. That he told the jury it's our burden to prove that. The other circuits, which have considered it, said it's not plaintiff's burden, it's a defense burden. If the judge is going to instruct on burdens, and I think it's within his discretion to do that, although I think it's within his discretion not to do that, if he is going to instruct on burdens, the burden should not rest with the plaintiff to prove that the officers did not have exigent circumstances.
Mr. Flaxman, if I can return you to the question of who ought to have the burden of proof. The government in its brief, City of Chicago in its brief, says that who has the superior knowledge is not and usually has not been the controlling factor on that issue. And secondly, at page 21 of its brief, it says that the government, it says that it really disputes that the police always have the superior understanding of the circumstances in the emergency situation. I'd like to get your comment on both of those.
On page 21, they cite a consent case. The Matlock is consent obtained from a third party. It's not it's not what the officers knew. And then they cite an unpublished, which I think is non-citable decision, the Antonelli case, which is, again, is a consent case. To page 21. So they're not talking about exigent circumstances where it's traditionally in.
Let's go back to their major premise, though, which, as I understand it, is that the who has the superior knowledge is not the controlling factor in the allocation of burdens of proof. Do you accept that?
No, I do not accept that.
Why not?
Because when one party knows something that the other party doesn't know and is required to, in the regular criminal Fourth Amendment, be able to justify why they entered it, they should have the same burden in a civil case. What that really segues into, if I may, is what were the articulable facts that the officers knew that justified the entry into Mrs. Bogan's home? They hadn't seen anybody go in there. They hadn't heard anybody go in there. Nobody told them that he was in there.
They were under the mistaken belief that the door to her apartment did not lead to her apartment, but to the back porch. Now, first of all, are you debating that that was a mistaken belief?
That's not a plausible claim, and the jury, which heard that, also heard subjective evidence about that.
You dispute the reasonableness of that judgment?
Yes. If we look at the pictures, which are set out in the brief,
yes,
we see one apartment, a door, a hallway, another door. We see iron gates in front of the doors. The officer said, well, I never saw the door to the first apartment. The hallway is 8 feet long. I didn't see the staircase. I didn't see the iron bars. I didn't see the door which said eviction. There was an eviction notice that it was taped on, that was glued to the door. I didn't see any of that. I thought I was going to the mudroom. The jury shouldn't have been able to hear these subjective beliefs of the officers about what they believe, if they believe the suspect was inside there, because there was no articulable basis for going in there. And then once they got in there, they searched. When they knew it wasn't the mudroom, when they knew it wasn't the back porch, they searched looking for the offender. Why did they do that? Well, they were inside and they might as well look, but there was no reason to believe he was in there. The flash message was that there's a man on the back porch, first floor, second floor, and no indication.
Mr. Flaxman, in the earlier conversations, we've been talking about the parties in terms of knowledge, and you've been talking about the government and the individual police officers as if they're the same parties. Would you agree with me that in the criminal case, where the burden is on the prosecution, it is the government as a whole that's the party, whereas in your case under Section 1983, it's individual police officers who face individual liability under federal law.
In fairness to the officer, I would allow them to rely on the collective knowledge of the officers, that if there had been an officer who saw the offender come into the back door, that would be a different case. We didn't have any evidence about that. We had evidence of a flash measure that there's a man on the back porch of the first floor, the second floor, nothing that he came in from the back porch, and then the officers try to break the door down and enter and search.
Thank you, Mr. Flaxman.
Thank you.
For the defense, Ms. Hornstra.
May I please the court? This is, of course, a civil case, a Section 1983 tort action. And as we explain in our brief, the proper allocation of the burden of proof in a civil tort case is on the plaintiff to prove each and every element of her case. And the burden in a criminal case to prove the reasonableness of a warrantless search has no place. It's not proper to put it on the defendant in a civil case. The Valens case from this circuit carefully considered the distinction between and explained why it's not appropriate to apply the burden that's applied to the government in criminal cases to the defense in civil cases. And I think it is a serious overstatement to say that other circuits have gone the other way from the Seventh Circuit. A number of cases that we cite in our brief in a footnote, I believe it's on page 24, footnote 5, they are good examples of a number of cases where courts have in passing. If you look at these cases, it's boilerplate discussing exceptions to the warrant requirement, and as part of that boilerplate, they say something about the government's burden. In none of those cases is the burden of proof at trial at issue, or is it dispositive?
Comment on the Liguano case. Doesn't that kind of point the other way?
To be honest, Your Honor, that was the language in there, taken on its own, squarely, says what the plaintiff's position is. We explain in our brief, I think, that it should be considered, I think, kind of a it was a direction on remand. There's no indication that the court analyzed the issue or that it was briefed. I think it was kind of a one-off.
How about the Supreme Court's writing? I will characterize whether it's dictum or not in Groh and County of Riverside.
Well,
I believe they're cited in your opponent's brief as creating a strong presumption. That there's a strong presumption against exceptions in the warrant requirement, and intimating that the party that wants to rebut those presumptions ought to have the burden.
Well, as we explained,
page 18 of their brief, I believe they say.
This is in the plaintiff's opening brief.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as the court explained in Valence, there is, of course, a presumption of unreasonableness that attaches to warrantless searches. But that doesn't mean in a civil case that what that does mean is that there is a burden of production. So if a plaintiff brings a case with a warrantless search and that's conceded, the defendant doesn't come up with any explanation, although the plaintiff should be entitled to judgment on that.
It's a burden of production.
That's Valence.
That's burden of production.
Yeah. Hmm.
That's correct, and that Valence explains that, and we think that that's the correct approach, and that there's not any meaningful distinction between the holding in Valence on consent, where the exception was consent, and where the exception is exigent circumstances.
This is raised by your opponents, and I need to get your reaction to it. How do we write an opinion in this case, sustaining this search operation, without sending a message to the police that during a police chase like this in an apartment complex, they can just round up everybody in the place and hold them until a fugitive is apprehended?
I don't think it's necessary to send that message at all, because that's not what happens here.
I hope it's not, but I want you to tell me how I can write this and not say that, and not intimate that, not be that the message we send. What is the limiting principle, in other words, here?
A jury heard this case and was asked to decide whether the officer's actions in entering Ms. Bogan's home were unreasonable and decided that they weren't. And that verdict was supported by the evidence. And this is a fast-moving situation. The plaintiff...
They're going to tell me it's a fast-moving situation every time they come here.
But also what has to be taken into account is the nature of the intrusion and how the officers acted under the circumstances. The jury assessed the reasonableness of the officer's belief that at the time that they were trying to forcibly enter her apartment, they didn't realize there was another apartment. By the time they entered her apartment, there were 10 officers already inside. And it's a very curious thing about this case that there's no complaint made about the initial officers that came in. And by the plaintiff's account, 10 to 12 officers came in her back door. She may not be complaining about that because she consented to it.
Does the record show where'd that back door go?
It led to an enclosed rear porch on the second floor. So there was a front door and a back door to the apartment.
Was that porch just for her apartment, or did it extend along the building?
I believe it was just her apartment. I think there were only two apartments on the second floor. And that's another thing about this. You know, there are a lot of apartment buildings in Chicago. There are two flats, three flats that only have one apartment building per floor. And so when the officers left this kitchen and the door was open, they saw another door there. And at that moment, you know, they didn't know the length of the building. And so they thought they were pounding on a door that led out to the back. Where they had heard, it was 2:30 in the morning, they heard that there was a man out there who roughly matched the description of the man they were chasing, thought, let's go through that door and get him there. So by the time they went in, again, there were 10 officers already in there. All the officers did was briefly search the place. There's no complaint really about the manner in which they did it. So there was certainly evidence to support the jury's verdict that this overall was a reasonable thing for the police to do.
One other question, if I may, about cases you cited on page 22 of your brief. You cite this Jacobs case. I gather you read that case as simply a pleading case and nothing more. Is that right?
Simply a what?
A pleading case.
I think so. I think it properly reflects the burden of production that we discussed. That in that case, you know, the defendants tried to defeat a complaint at the pleading stage by raising exigent circumstances when there wasn't anything in there. And again, in the Jacobs case, you know, that was kind of a comment in passing about the burden of proof that cited a criminal case. But regardless of where the burden of proof was at trial, dismissal would have been inappropriate at the pleading stage.
And finally, I've got to ask you about page 20. You have this, without any citation, this assertion that the allocation of burden of proof has nothing to do with what party has superior knowledge. Is that generally true in the common law?
In the context of the Fourth Amendment, there's no indication in Valance that its discussion had anything to do with the knowledge of which party. I don't know of cases where I don't know of any examples of where courts look at fact-specific, who's got superior knowledge on this fact.
Sometimes they look at genres of cases, though, and in some cases, and on particular issues, and shift the burden. That's really what we're discussing today.
And I think, as we explain in our brief, as an empirical matter, there's just no way to say that cases that involve consent are, things that plaintiffs know about, whereas cases that involve exigent circumstances are things that defendants know about. And in fact,
yes,
the law...
You make that assertion as well, that you really debate whether or not the police are always the party that knows more about exigent circumstances. Could you expand on that a little bit?
That's right, because in a great many cases, a civil rights plaintiff complaining about a search, the plaintiff himself or a member of his or her family is the target of the search, the person that the police officers are looking for. In a case like that, the plaintiff will know as much as the police. And it's certainly well established in the circuit that in a case alleging unlawful arrest, that it's the plaintiff's burden to prove lack of probable cause. And probable cause, of course, is judged based on the facts known to the officer at the time. So certainly that's a matter within the officer's knowledge, possibly sometimes too within the plaintiff's. But what it comes down to is, the fundamental issue of the proper allocation of a party's burden in a civil case. And again, the cases from other circuits that state in passing that they, you know, that reflect the criminal cases are really.
I'm frankly not sure that it's fair to describe them as just stating it in passing. They were important to this court's decisions. I understand your point that they simply borrowed without comment the law from the criminal cases, and we can take that into account as we evaluate balance. But I'm not sure we can treat it as just dicta or passing comments.
You know, actually, of the cases that I looked at, they really are, were, I mean, I can, you know, they were cases like the Hardesty versus Hamburg Township was actually affirming summary judgment for the defendants on the Fourth Amendment claim. It was part of a boilerplate discussion. The only case where I think it might have made a difference was the Third Circuit's discussion in Parkers versus Trapp, which actually applied a very stringent view of, you know, what was required to show exigent circumstances, and it seems to differ from this court's analyses of those issues, so it may differ from
our sister circuit, nevertheless.
That's right. So I mean, in the cases I've looked at, other than maybe Parker's, I'm satisfied that it is dicta in those cases.
Okay.
I see my time
Thank
has
you,
expired.
Ms. Mr. Flaxman, your time expired. If you'd like 1 minute in rebuttal, you may have it.
I, at the risk of speaking too much, the comment was made that all the officers did was briefly search her apartment. They did that without a warrant. They did that at 3 a.m. in the morning. They did that with drawn guns. That's the point of the Fourth Amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flaxman. The case is taken under advisement.